Of all the predictions that pundits have gotten wrong in recent decades, one of the most compelling has to do with cities. Cities were supposed to die out. The proliferation of the automobile meant that everyone would move to the suburbs, never come back. The decline of urban manufacturing meant that the city itself would decline. And then there's all the crime and noise and pollution and chaos that cities are known for. Who on earth would ever want to live in any city? As it turns out, just about everyone. We're in the middle of an historic and wholly unpredicted rise in urbanization. It's happening here in America and all over the world. One problem, many of our cities are old, which means they're not exactly optimized for the 21st century, and it's not so easy to retrofit an entire city. So, how about building a new city for the 21st century and beyond from scratch?
Our mission is to use technology to really redefine urban life in the 21st century.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, a look at the city of the future with a man who's been rebuilding New York City for the past few decades, a man some people call a modern-day Robert Moses, the controversial master builder of decades past.
Look, I think if somebody says it in meaning that they got a lot done, then I think it's a compliment. I think if somebody says, oh, you did a lot of top-down planning and you displaced lots of people, then it would be an insult. It would also, I think, not be true.
Along the way, he learned the central paradox of successful cities.
The question is, how do you actually manage supply and demand?
A conversation with the mightily credentialed urbanist Dan Doctoroff. Take a seat, get comfortable. That's what he did.
I am sitting, I'm leaning back, I'm smoking a cigar.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If you happen to live in New York City, as I do, there's a name that's been routinely popping up for a few decades now, always attached to interesting and often controversial projects.
Sure. I'm Dan Doctoroff.
Now, don't worry if you haven't heard of Doctoroff. He's not quite a household name, but his fingerprints are all over the biggest city in the United States. He grew up in Michigan, became a New Yorker quite reluctantly. It just wasn't his kind of place, but he settled in. He and his wife started raising their family here. He worked in investment banking and private equity, seemingly just another money harvester from the provinces who finds the urban riches too good to pass up. This went on for years.
And along the way, I came up with this crazy idea that New York ought to host the Olympics. And eventually that idea became a bit of a movement. It drew the attention of Mike Bloomberg, who at the time was just an ordinary billionaire and I don't think was even seriously thinking about running for mayor, but he joined our board, gave some money.
Michael Bloomberg wasn't seriously thinking about running for mayor, much less being mayor, which, as you may know, also describes the arc of our current president. Donald Trump's run for president apparently started out as a means of enlarging the Trump brand. Bloomberg's run for mayor of New York City was apparently his way of enlarging Bloomberg LP, the financial information company that made him rich. But voters, well, voters are funny animals. Bloomberg, while short on charm, had a certain appeal. Smart, self-made, fiercely pragmatic, and he spoke his mind, often to the detriment of the people he was speaking about. He was the opposite of a career politician. And then the Twin Towers were obliterated in the September 11th terrorist attack. Less than 2 months later, Mike Bloomberg was elected New York's 108th mayor. Now what? Bloomberg, a political neophyte facing a recovery of unknown dimensions, invited some other neophytes to help.
And when he unexpectedly won right after 9/11, he asked me to join him in City Hall. And so I became deputy mayor for economic development and rebuilding.
Dan Doctoroff did that job for 6 years.
He then asked me to go run his company, which I did for 7 years, Bloomberg LP.
When Bloomberg was finally done being mayor in 2013, after squeezing out a third term despite a pre-existing two-term limit, he considered running for president. He considered some other things, too. But then, to the surprise of many, he went back to Bloomberg LP.
And when he decided he wanted to come back to the company, I left. And tremendous relationship with him, but decided I just didn't want to go back to being his deputy mayor anymore, and formed a company with Google called Sidewalk Labs.
And that's where Doctoroff can be found today as CEO of Sidewalk Labs, whose mission is...
Our mission is really to use technology to redefine urban life in the 21st century, and we want to do it by literally building a city or a district of a city. And we have chosen Toronto to do that.
Okay, let's back up a bit to before Dan Doctoroff was a known quantity. So you were, for many years, obsessed with the idea of bringing the Olympics, the Summer Olympics, to New York City. And you toiled first in obscurity for a while, spending a lot of your own money, recruiting a lot of people to your cause. You got some leverage over time. You got in the Bloomberg administration. You were first reluctant to take that job because you thought it would curtail your Olympic activity, but Mike Bloomberg persuaded you that it actually would give you leverage. You got delayed. You wanted it to be 2008. Yeah, it got pushed to 2012 Olympics. You pursued. You traveled the world, did everything you could. Finally, New York was voted the U.S. City in the bid, and then ultimately lost out in the IOC, in the International Olympic Committee vote.
Sounds pretty nutty, doesn't it?
You know, I don't mean to be dismissive of the Olympics themselves, but was the Olympic bid on some level kind of a stalking horse to rebuild New York City, whether the Olympics came here or not? And is it possible that New York perhaps benefited more from the bid for the Olympics and all the infrastructure and related benefits that it produced than it would have benefited from actually hosting it?
I wouldn't describe it as a stalking horse. I would just say that that was always part of a strategy, that it was sort of the off-ramp from the strategy that, you know, the Olympics could be the catalyst to getting things done that people have been talking about for generations but never were able to muster the political will or financial resources to actually do. And you could look at successful examples in the past as to how they'd use the deadlines at the bidding for the Olympics, or more likely hosting the Olympics, created sort of an imperative in a city. So Tokyo in 1964 built the subway system around it. You know, Barcelona in 1992 did an amazing job of recovering from being a stepchild to Madrid under Franco for decades and revitalizing the city.
You're leaving out the counterexamples like Athens, but I mean, it's not quite a science of what kind of region will benefit from.
And it all depends on the planning, and it depends on the economic resources and other things. But I convinced myself that where New York was in its development cycle, having that kind of catalyst could be a really important thing. And we use the deadline of the Olympic decision to get massive rezonings done in time, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the second question you asked was, are we better off having not won? And there, I think the answer is no, because I think we could have used another 7 years of deadlines to get more stuff done, perhaps.
Imagine our subway today if we'd gotten the Olympics,
right? Well, you know, I think that might have had a real impact, right? We could have argued, look, all these people are coming. I think it could have been a deadline to getting, for example, congestion pricing done. But at the end of the day, you know, much of what we wanted to do as part of the Olympic plan, and that was redeveloping the waterfront, you know, in Brooklyn or Queens or the whole west side of Manhattan or the High Line or regeneration in Coney Island and Harlem and Flushing, areas that had been largely ignored for a long period of time, got a big boost from the fact that we bid for the Olympics.
I'd love you to give me, Dan, in just a minute or two, what you would consider the best accomplishments of the Bloomberg administration.
Well, in my area, I think we fundamentally redefined the economy and land use of New York for literally much of the next century. And I think the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site in Lower Manhattan has to rise to the top of that list because it was an emotional, financial, physical imperative. The legacy of parks all over the city, and whether that's the High Line, Brooklyn Bridge Park, or Fresh Kills, which is a huge park built on a dump in Staten Island, or lots of others, I think will be an important legacy.
How should a city like New York or any city address the paradox that if you're a successful city, you'll inevitably become expensive? And then those cities become unaffordable for a lot of people. So there have been historical government interventions like rent control and rent stabilization, which are, at least in the eyes of economists, nearly always a terrible idea, that they create perverse incentives and they lead to dilapidated housing stock and so on. On the other hand, your administration promoted this somewhat more market-based 80-20 solution, market level versus subsidized. And that seems to sort of-ish be working, but not anywhere near to the satisfaction of affordable housing advocates.
If you look at what I'd call successful cities, cities that where there's a lot of demand and the population is growing, which I, by the way, think is the mark of a successful city, right? You're attracting customers, people want to come. The question that I think you posed is how do you actually manage supply and demand more effectively? You want more people to come. I don't think you want to have slow that down because cities can either go two ways. They can go up or they can go down. You're not smart enough to ever manage it so that you can kind of keep things completely in balance. So it really becomes a question of how do you produce more supply? And there's really only two things that you need in order to do that. You need land for people to build on, and you need money in order to subsidize it for people at all income levels. We saw that right from the very beginning of the Bloomberg administration. We believed the city was going to grow, and that's why at a time when we had no money, we created what was to become an $8 billion affordable housing program that produced 165,000 units of affordable housing, which basically means subsidized housing. The question is that when you look back on it, did we do enough? And the answer is no. We let demand get out ahead of supply. It was really a market timing issue. And what ended up happening was we were keeping things more or less in balance for the first 5 or 6 years of the Bloomberg administration. We were accommodating the growth. The prices weren't going up that dramatically. Homelessness, in fact, was starting to come down. Then what happened was the financial crisis. The city actually, in part because a lot of the other economic development initiatives, bounced back dramatically faster than ordinarily would have been the case. In fact, the city recovered faster than the national average for the first time following a financial panic, crisis, or bust. Yet, when you have a financial crisis, financing largely grinds to a halt. And so there was a big pause in terms of the production of affordable housing. And that's, I think, when supply and demand got out of whack.
As someone who's been in business a lot before and after your political time, how, I guess, grubby or corrupt or unworkable is politics compared to business?
In New York City, the amount of so-called grubbiness was, I think, minimal. Pretty much the only times that we had real problems, certain exceptions to this, was when somebody from the state legislature actually got involved. You know, a good story of grubbiness is we decided to rezone the waterfront in Brooklyn. After World War II, New York City literally lost almost all of its manufacturing. And so the waterfront, which had these spectacular views of Manhattan across the river, had essentially been abandoned. So it was, you know, dilapidated wharves and warehouses and factories. And so we decided we were going to turn it into, you know, one of the more desirable parts of New York fit for sort of a 21st century economy. So we worked on this rezoning for about 2 years. This was while I was bidding for the Olympics. I literally, on the day before the vote in the city council. I arrive back from Korea, where I was, you know, lobbying for votes. And I'm called into City Hall because there was a snag in our rezoning. It turns out that the state representative, you know, Vito Lopez from the district, had his hand out. And what he wanted was $1 million for a daycare center that I think his girlfriend had some involvement in. And I literally, after midnight, called the head of the agency that oversaw sort of daycare centers, woke him up in the middle of the night. I'd never actually talked to him before. I said, you know, you don't know me, but I need a favor. Can I count on you for $1 million for this daycare center? He said groggily, yes, and we got the deal done. You know, sometimes there were just like insurmountable obstacles. They usually occurred at the state level. The politics there really can be awful. At one point, I think the New York Times counted up, and something like 35 legislators had been convicted of various crimes. That included the Speaker of the State Assembly, as well as the Senate Majority Leader.
And let's not forget governors, Eliot Spitzer, of course.
We had Eliot Spitzer, too. And so we tried to avoid the state, honestly, as much as possible. But sometimes we just couldn't avoid them. A good example of that was the stadium on the west side of Manhattan. As part of the Olympic bid and as part of the Hudson Yards plan, we proposed a stadium over part of the rail yards that are on the west side. And, you know, we just couldn't find a way to get around the state legislature. And eventually this really one guy who was the Speaker of the Assembly, who has been convicted of corruption, blocked it without a vote and did it for lots of reasons, none of which I'm sure we'll ever know, including the fact that he had a cozy relationship with Madison Square Garden, which opposed it. I mean, it just sort of went on and on and on.
Coming up after the break, what cities should and should not do to keep corporations happy.
Providing these sorts of incentives was like giving them crack.
How city officials can and cannot predict the future.
I will confess, I didn't see that right away.
What Dan Doctoroff is working on now.
The building literally moves.
And the real meaning of the pilot city he's helping build in Toronto.
Our purpose here is to demonstrate how that combination of innovation and urban design can fundamentally bend the curve on quality of life.
That's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a new podcast that explores the work of changemakers across the country and highlights projects in cities like Miami, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Dan Doctoroff started his New York City life as just another banker, who then got obsessed with bringing the Olympics to New York, who then joined the Bloomberg administration to help New York recover from the 9/11 attack, who then paired the recovery effort with the Olympic dream to dramatically reshape the New York that exists today. One of his projects at the moment is a new cultural center on the west side of Manhattan called The Shed, of which Doctoroff is chairman and president. The Shed, I was just curious about the why-ness of it. Why did New York City need another arts complex? You, I understand, are not exactly a performing arts fiend, at least.
Yeah, well, the origin of it actually dates back to when we replanned the west side of Manhattan, which we did in two separate parts. One Part of it was in West Chelsea, and the core of it was to save the High Line. The second part was to build what's called Hudson Yards, which is this area on the far west side of Manhattan. And we decided at the intersection of the High Line and Hudson Yards, we wanted to have a cultural institution. We set two standards for it. One, it should be unlike anything else in New York, which is hard because there's 1,200 cultural institutions in New York. And secondly, that it should play a role in keeping New York on the leading edge culturally in the world. And so we eventually had an insight about the role of technology and the role that it's playing in reshaping the cultural ecosystem that led us to conclude that what New York needed was a completely different kind of institution, one that would be the most flexible, both programmatically and physically.
Right. So this is a building that kind of can be reconfigured like a transformer or something, yes?
It's exactly right. It's like a transformer. It's really remarkable. The building literally moves, and it will open up in March 29th, is what we're targeting, 2019, and it may be one of the largest cultural startups of all time.
And the CEO, a fellow named Alex Poots, ran for many years the Manchester International Festival, which, again, is unusual in that it takes place, or took place at least, all over the city, not in set theaters. From what I can gather, the Shed seems to be a sort of, professionalized guerrilla operation in a way, right? It's got a lot of the experimentalism of the experimental arts movement with kind of the juice and leverage of a big city like New York.
That's a great way of saying it. You know, another way of expressing is it's a cultural festival every day because there's multiple spaces that can be reconfigured that can accommodate virtually any cultural discipline. I mean, look, our basic view, whether it's with respect to culture or whether it's with respect to city building, is nobody's smart enough to predict the future. So you cannot plan to the detail or even sort of the gross level what's going to happen in the future. Instead, what you can do is create the infrastructure that might be physical, it might be digital, might be some ground rules, et cetera, that enable people to project their own ideas and innovations onto it as taste, technologies, trends begin to change. And I think that is a very different notion of a cultural institution as well as city building.
I find it, and I mean zero disrespect by this, but I find it interesting that of all the things that attract people to New York City these days, outsiders, visitors, the High Line is among the most popular. It was proposed that it be turned into this, you know, public park and strolling area, and you were not a big supporter of it, not that you were so hard against it. But it's just a striking reminder or illustration, I guess, to me that you and your folks around you, who were obviously doing this central infrastructure planning, you couldn't have possibly predicted that something like that, and as humble as the High Line, for God's sake, and it's an abandoned freight line, would turn into this thing that has so much appeal. And I'm just curious what kind of lesson that taught you.
When I came into City Hall, the High Line was really one court decision away from being torn down. And the Giuliani administration, which had preceded us, was really intent on ripping it down because the landowners who owned land under the High Line really were really pressuring the Giuliani administration to get rid of it. And, you know, there were some of us in the administration who immediately saw what the two young guys who had basically kept it alive saw, which is that this could be a beautiful park and amenity. I will confess, I didn't see that right away. But the key point is that, you know, you seize opportunities as you see them and as they evolve. And if you're flexible enough to do that, then ultimately you can create something that might be amazing.
I mean, the paradox in that is flexibility is not a hallmark of government, is it?
Well, it generally is not because government is really hard. And just getting anything done often takes extraordinary effort, but it should be, on some level, a hallmark of government. At the same time, you have to have a sense for what you want to do, and so you have to combine sort of this openness with a determination to get things done or else nothing ever happens. You know, one of the principles that we always operated with is that, look, we're a competitive entity in New York. And whether we were competing with London or Los Angeles or Jersey City, to be honest, you know, we can't make policy that puts us at a competitive disadvantage.
Let me ask you about that competition between whether it's faraway cities or near cities. You and the Bloomberg administration made it a point to change policy and stop throwing a lot of money at firms or institutions that threaten to leave, using that kind of standard financial incentive. But I'm curious what effects that zero-sum competition has on each area, because, you know, on some dimensions, I'd imagine the competition is healthy, right? On the other hand, firms and institutions can and do game the system and basically skim a bunch of taxpayer money for their own purposes. So what's the best way to balance that and still incentivize firms and institutions to be where they can do the most good?
Our view was that financial incentives to lure companies, or more importantly, keep them, was almost always a fool's errand. We did a lot of work when we first came in. The economy was just on its back. You know, we were facing enormous budget deficits. So the easy temptation would have been to bribe companies to stay or bribe companies to come. We met with CEOs of companies all over the country and all over the world, in addition to in New York. We analyzed their cost structures in great detail. And eventually what we concluded was companies are going to do what's in their economic interest over the long run, and that providing these sorts of incentives was like giving them crack. But the crack was ultimately going to affect the dealer more than the user. And so it just didn't make a lot of sense. And so we just stopped. Instead, the way we'd compete was based on our natural strengths, which we thought we could enhance. And our number one natural strength was that New York had been a haven for people from all over the world. You know, it was sort of this optimistic sense that produces incredible energy that attracted companies to New York. And we ought to build off of that. Most places have some sort of competitive advantage, but they got to be honest about what it was. And so that, for us, was really what the strategy became. You know, you got to be true to yourself. That's one of the things that I consistently preach to leaders in cities around the country and around the world. You know, cities are like people, or maybe like companies. They have personalities. They have strengths and weaknesses. You know how hard it is to change your own personality. It's hard to change a city's personality, but that doesn't mean you can't, you know, structure around your strengths and structure around your weaknesses.
But cities, unlike people or even companies, can be, as we noted earlier, difficult to retrofit. Not just physically, all those buildings, all that transportation and energy infrastructure, but also psychically and culturally and economically. Which is why, Doctoroff concluded, it would be really interesting to start a city from scratch. In 2015, he teamed up with Google to create a company called Sidewalk Labs.
And our mission is to really help to redefine urban life in the 21st century, combining cutting-edge innovation with great urban planning. And the way we want to do that is by demonstrating to the world what that can be in a specific place. And so we have chosen Toronto for a variety of great reasons.
Give me a few great reasons.
Well, one is they have a remarkable piece of land on their waterfront. The second is that we've partnered with a governmental entity called Waterfront Toronto, which for the last 15 years has been developing the waterfront. But what's really significant about them is that they are a tri-governmental agency. So they're effectively owned by the City of Toronto, the Province of Ontario, and the National Government of Canada. So there's incredible alignment. But beyond that, Toronto is a city that has a really kind of rich urbanist tradition. Jane Jacobs, for example, fled New York for Toronto. But they also have a really powerful and growing technology ecosystem. And then beyond that, there's the dynamics of the city itself. It's one of the fastest growing cities in North America. In fact, it's probably the most diverse large city in the world. But what's actually happening, and it comes back to some of the conversation we were having earlier, is because it's growing so fast, there are increasing pressures on affordability, on mobility, and how people get around. All of that is pushing middle income and lower middle and lower income people out from kind of access to employment, which is creating opportunity challenges. They're so committed to this notion of inclusion, but ironically, because that openness has produced the pressures that are making it harder to be inclusive, they're very open to new approaches. And so we want to create a place, ultimately of large scale, that can be a laboratory for innovation across sort of every urban system, including mobility, sustainability, building form and design, public space, and then even community and social services, in which we leverage technology to fundamentally bend the curve on a lot of those quality of life metrics.
When you say create a space, just to be clear, you are talking about this is essentially a physical neighborhood you're building, correct?
We think of it as a district.
And can you just talk about what would be the most overt, I guess, futuristic elements of the construction of this area? For instance, I assume that a lot of functions that are currently above ground in a lot of cities, like freight delivery and trash disposal, those will not be above ground.
All of that is true, but I think the thing that'll have the most profound impact is if you don't allow traditional vehicles, particularly automobiles, into the district.
So it's all autonomous summoned vehicles then, essentially, yes?
That's our, and ideally much more shared than they are today. So if you begin to do that, the consequences are truly profound. In a typical North American city, 30 to 40% of the land is dedicated to parking or the separation of roadways that these highly dangerous vehicles demand. If you begin to carve most of that back, you can create greater density. You can also, however, dramatically increase the amount of public open space. If you can begin to put people very close to open space and you can figure out ways to weatherize that, particularly in places like Toronto where the weather is not so nice a large percentage of the time, then maybe you can begin to reconceive space in people's apartments in new ways, which will also be enhanced by enabling people to store a lot of their stuff off-site, because with autonomous delivery, it'll be much easier and convenient. And you combine that with new approaches to construction, like modular construction or perhaps cross-laminated timber, then you can begin to meaningfully lower the cost of housing. You combine the lowering the cost of housing with lowering the cost of mobility, which we believe is really possible by as much as 50%, and you can begin to see cost of living decreases that are meaningfully into the double digits.
Now, the people who will live there, as I understand it, are opting in to a program to have a great deal of their personal data gathered, because this is a laboratory and you want to learn as much as you can from the data of how people move around and communicate and so on. One interview you gave, you said that the data really shouldn't be used to be commercialized.
Right.
But this is a project run by, funded by a company, Google, for whom commercializing data is its actual business model. So why on earth would we think that these data won't be commercialized? And why on earth shouldn't we think that this entire project is just an extension of Google's already monolithic reach?
We're just going to have to demonstrate to people through agreements, engagement, specific actions, that that's not our intent at all. And by the way, it's not Google or Alphabet's intent at all either. Our purpose here is to demonstrate how that combination of innovation and urban design can fundamentally bend the curve on quality of life. And to the extent data gets used, it's going to get used for those purposes. But we have to prove it to people and memorialize that in different ways, and that we will do. So we understand the skepticism, and we will satisfy people over the course of 2018, which is our year to really put the plan together, including privacy and data protection plans of our intentions. So, yeah, I mean, look, I believe in something I call the virtuous cycle of the successful city. You know, the objective of a city should be to grow. And that is grow the number of residents, grow the number of jobs, grow the number of visitors, because the marginal revenue of those additional people is greater than the marginal cost, and that you can take that net profit, if you will, and reinvest it back in quality of life in the city, in affordable housing, in education, in safety, in social services. And when you do that and you improve quality of life, more people come, perpetuating the virtuous cycle.
So when can I move there?
Well, if all goes well, you know, the first people could probably move in maybe 5 years or so. But then that would be a place to prototype a lot of the interesting ideas and approaches. But obviously, a lot of the systems have to scale into a larger area. This is a project that would, you know, take 15 to 20 years for sure.
That's Dan Doctoroff, CEO of Sidewalk Labs. If you want to learn more about the Olympic bid and rebuilding New York, check out his book, Greater Than Ever, New York's Big Comeback. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, when corporations engage in philanthropy, their motivation may not be, surprise of surprises, purely charitable. And for more episodes like this one, check out the Freakonomics Radio podcast, which is available on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. Also at Freakonomics.com, where you can find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a podcast on changemakers and the projects they're championing in communities nationwide. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at progressive.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I'm sure you've been hearing the ever more anguished calls to regulate the huge tech firms known collectively as GAFA, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple.
These companies, these super large platform monopolists, they have developed the capacity to manipulate us, to control the information that is delivered to us, to control the pricing at which products are delivered to us, to control us as producers.
The GAFA companies are far bigger, richer, and arguably more dominant than tech companies in the past. Google, for instance, has 90% of global search engine market share. Facebook has more than 2 billion monthly active users. Amazon has an estimated 95 million Prime members in the U.S. That's something like 75% of all American households. It's estimated that almost 50% of all online spending goes to Amazon. This kind of scale creates a lot of concern. We've examined this concern in previous episodes, like who runs the internet and is the internet being ruined?
We're seeing the birth of a new center of power, real power. We depend on these technologies that have been in many ways wonderful and fascinating, but they're making significant decisions unilaterally.
There's also the question of whether the mission of these firms is as socially beneficial as many people believe they were in the early days of the internet.
There's all these really smart engineers. They're the brightest computer scientists. And all they're thinking about is, how do I keep someone on Facebook for 10 more minutes? What's the exact combination of things that will keep them stay on the site as long as possible so that we can show them as much advertisement as possible?
So here's a question. If you were one of those huge, dominant, super wealthy firms, what would you do to ensure that the good times stay good? You'd probably spend a lot of money lobbying politicians, which, yes, they do. There's been a huge ramping up lately in lobbying by tech firms. But you might also do something a bit subtler than that. Our story today begins with a journalist.
I'm Franklin Foer, a writer with The Atlantic.
You are one of three brothers who write books. Talk about that for just a minute and the family that produced all of you.
Right. So I have two brothers, Jonathan, who's written a good number of novels, including Everything is Illuminated. And I got a younger brother named Josh, who is a science writer who wrote a book called Moonwalking with Einstein. And it's actually incredibly uncomfortable for us to talk about growing up in a family of other writers, just because I'm sure in some ways we benefit from the novelty act of being three brotherly writers, but then we all, of course, want to be known for our own accomplishments.
Right.
But, you know, our parents didn't do anything. They didn't force us to play violin 4 hours a day or sit down and study the great chess masters. We watched a lot of He-Man and Addams Family reruns on television when we were growing up. But one of the things that they did was they gave us a credit card, which they said we weren't allowed to spend essentially on anything except in the event of an incredible emergency. And there was one exception to this, which is that they said that we could basically spend the credit card at will at the bookshop. And so they basically guided us to one thing.
Your first job in journalism was at Slate, one of the very first mainstream online publications, which was started by Microsoft. And so there was this huge enthusiasm, certainly among the chattering classes.
There was a certain amount of utopianism associated with the emergence of the internet, this idea that we were going to tie the world together. I love search engines. I love the fact that I can access every book in human history in a nanosecond. I love that I can get things delivered to my door incredibly quickly. And these things arguably make life much better, and maybe inarguably make life much better. So these technologies were incredible. I mean, Amazon is an incredible company. The Kindle is an incredible invention. The iPad and the iPhone were incredible innovations. And so I think we were right to marvel at them.
So after writing for Slate for a while, you moved on to the New Republic, as you call it, the intellectual organ for hard-nosed liberalism. You ultimately became editor there not once, but twice.
So the New Republic was this little magazine that always had outsized influence in politics and culture. It was an incredibly elitist organ, and it managed to persist over 100 years while never really turning a profit. And so as we entered the internet age, that became a more and more difficult thing to continue to do. And so we ended up shifting from one ownership group to the next. And I got so exhausted trying to find an owner and kind of sick of that, I ended up resigning as editor. But then a couple years after I resigned, the magazine got bought by a guy called Chris Hughes, who'd been Mark Zuckerberg's roommate at Harvard and co-founder of Facebook. And he bought the magazine. And to me, this seemed like almost too good to be true. That you had this guy who understood social media, who had incredible number of resources and seemed devoted to this little magazine that I was also devoted to. And so I came back and I edited the magazine, and Chris and I tried to remake it.
And the relationship in the beginning seemed like it was unbelievably good.
Yeah, we became really good friends, and it was exhilarating. We felt like we were trying to save something that was imperiled in the world, and that maybe we could help provide some sort of dignified solution to the rest of journalism, which was grappling with a lot of the same issues that we were grappling with. But there was a moment when things just took this turn, which was that Chris decided that he'd always talked about wanting to make a profit with the New Republic, and he suddenly decided that he didn't want to lose, at least not lose a whole lot of money with it. And so we had to turn around our financial position incredibly quickly. And so he insisted that we start chasing clicks. In 2013, the surest way to get clicks was to post a clip from last night's Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And you slap a headline on it, and you maybe write a couple sentences about it, and everybody would click on it.
And you got caught up in at least monitoring the numbers, right?
Yes, I did. Look, data is crack cocaine. And if you're the guy who had a hard time getting a date in high school, to suddenly find yourself producing things that are extremely popular, you become obsessed with replicating that popularity. You know, in some ways, everybody in the magazine wanted to be successful on Facebook. We wanted to master social media and this new environment, but we didn't want that new environment to dictate how we did our jobs.
All right. So we should say that you ended up quitting as you were about to be fired from the New Republic.
Yeah. So, I took the brave decision to resign when I learned that there was some guy who already had my job and was offering other people jobs at the New Republic.
It's funny. You're describing what was happening to you at the New Republic, but it sounds as though you're also perhaps describing your view of what happened at places like Google and Facebook over time, where you may begin with a certain set of motivations, but as those motivations lead you to this overwhelming commercial success, you're so seduced by the magnitude of that success that you can't help but want to replicate it over and over again.
Yeah, that's completely right. I felt like, in retrospect, I realized that I was just living this compressed version of recent history.
The recent history of the internet, at least. Over the years, Franklin Foer's view of the internet had shifted. The same guy who used to think this.
There was a certain amount of utopianism associated with the emergence of the internet.
And this.
I love search engines.
And this.
These technologies were incredible. I mean, Amazon is an incredible company.
Has now come to think this.
Amazon thinks of itself as the everything store. And it's gotten itself in pretty much every conceivable business. It owns Whole Foods. It powers the cloud. It houses data for the CIA and so on and so on. And there's really nothing that it doesn't try to squeeze into its empire.
He also thinks this.
As Facebook shapes the way that we consume news, as Google shapes the way that we interact with information, and as Amazon has shaped the way that we interact with books, the dominance that these companies exert ends up trickling through the cultural, intellectual ecosystem. And with Amazon, my concern is that the book business has become utterly dependent on them, that they hold one of the few true monopolies in the world.
Actually, that's not quite true.
My name is Swati Bhatt. I teach at Princeton.
One course she teaches, the economics of the internet.
The existence of a monopoly of a single firm in any product space, unless it's a government-granted monopoly, is rare in the digital economy.
So even though Amazon has, for instance, at least 70% of ebook sales, that doesn't make it a monopoly.
Technically, no, because that leaves 30% for some other set of firms.
When describing firms like Amazon, Google, and Facebook, Bhatt prefers the term behemoth.
Yes, there is a difference. Behemoth suggests that it's simply a large firm, whereas a monopoly suggests that it's the only firm.
Okay. Economic semantics aside, Bhatt does see strong parallels between these modern behemoths and what we traditionally think of as monopolies. But a modern tech behemoth has a particularly modern advantage.
So ownership of a scarce resource is the definition of a natural monopoly. And what we're seeing with the behemoths today is an ownership of a scarce resource called personal data, or data in general. And there's an interesting kind of a self-reinforcing dynamic here where as a firm transacts, buys and sells, it acquires data about its consumers, and that enables it to grow by producing more personalized products, by advertising more effectively. And that brings in more customers, which brings in more data, which then enables the firm to grow even further, and that leads to the behemoth status.
And that is what Franklin Foer and a growing chorus of other critics are so concerned about. Foer recently published a book called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. It's part memoir, part screed against the dominance of the big tech firms. It's not a particularly empirical book, and it's hard to say how much of Foer's argument was informed by personal experiences, like the New Republic disaster. It also turns out that Foer's family, in addition to encouraging his love of books, encouraged his distrust of monopolies.
So my dad was a University of Chicago trained lawyer who'd worked in the antitrust division of the Carter administration. And so I grew up in this household where antitrust was part of the family religion. My dad would drive around in a car that had a bumper sticker that said, "Bust the trust" on it. It was a real obsession and passion of his. And for a long time, he was this lonely activist who was railing for greater, more aggressive enforcement of these laws prohibiting monopolistic behavior. And I always admired him for this quixotic stand that he took, but I never really fully bought into his arguments until Amazon got in this fight with the book publishers when it started to hit close to home.
This was the Hachette deal, yes?
Yeah, exactly. Let's just say something about book publishing, which is that book publishing is an incredibly oligopolical industry, that there are, you know, four or five big companies that dominate book publishing, and they're oftentimes jerks. And so it's hard to have a whole lot of sympathy for the book publishers. But suddenly you have these five big companies that were up against one big company, which was Amazon. And Amazon basically controlled their access to the marketplace. And Amazon was renegotiating their ebook contract with the publishers one by one, trying to strong arm them with their market power into pricing their books lower and lower. And so to me, it was grotesque and ominous that Amazon was just able to use its market power to try to dictate to the publishers in this incredibly aggressive sort of way.
So where do you draw the line between winning or competing and being evil?
Right.
Persuade me that it's not just a case of big companies being really good at what they do and winning, and you kind of having sympathies with the people who are not winning.
So my book, in some ways, is a Valentine to competition, that I believe that a marketplace is most healthy when you have a number of market players. So I might not love book publishing. It might be too concentrated in some ways for my taste, but at least there are five companies competing against one another for the marketplace. And so if I don't like the way that one company is treating me, I can always go to another company. Or if I don't like the goods that one company is selling, I can go to another company. And the problem with Amazon and the problem with Google and to an extent with Facebook is that they become the only market player. And so the choice that we have as consumers is limited and competition is limited. So my argument is against the big technology companies, which really are racing to expand into every nook and cranny of our lives.
As it happens, this expansion has just raced into Franklin Foer's own life. We spoke to him last year, just before his book was being published, and there'd been a plot twist.
The New America Foundation supported my book.
The New America Foundation is a center-left think tank devoted to, quote, renewing American politics, prosperity, and purpose in the digital age. It's run by the political scientist Anne-Marie Slaughter, who's a former top official in the Obama State Department.
Yeah, one of the cool things that New America does is that they give money to journalists who are writing book projects. So, you know, I didn't get a lot of money from them, but I got a small sum, and they were especially generous to me because I'd just been fired from a job at the New Republic.
And the partial funding of Foer's book about the dominance of firms like Google suddenly became relevant because...
That's since become relevant just because they fired a vociferous critic of Google from the foundation, which is noteworthy because the foundation has received a fair amount of money from Google chairman Eric Schmidt.
Right. So how much fun is it for you to be publishing a new book and already distancing yourself from the foundation that funded the writing of it?
It actually doesn't feel good because New America has been supportive of me over time, and I'd rather not seem like a jerk and disavow them when they've been so nice to me. But this does feel like sadly reflective of a much bigger issue.
Who was the critic who was fired?
His name is Barry Lynn, and he ran something called the Open Markets Program there. A very active opponent of monopoly and a very vociferous critic of Google.
We used to have an affiliation with the New America Foundation, but we were kicked out of New America.
And that is Barry Lynn.
And I direct the Open Markets Institute.
So the name of his project has not been taken away, but his affiliation with the New America Foundation has.
We're working out of a WeWorks on the 1400 block of G Street in Washington.
Coming up next week on Freakonomics Radio, the story is not as neat as the headlines would have it.
At no point did Google or any funder tell me to fire Barry Lynn.
Also, how much gratitude do philanthropists and foundations deserve?
That's the attitude I want to try to sweep away.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio archive at freakonomics.com or listen to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.